The mind that knows sees the process. There's a feeling, anxiety, then a perception, this is bad, then mental formations, should be homeless, then consciousness, I have to tell her what to do. But when the mind goes to the Four Noble Truths and begins the Eightfold Path, the anxious mind won't let go. Much dukkha, how can I let go of this? Well, one of the things with the contemplation of dukkha is really just by actually already formulating in the mind and recognizing, oh wow, this is dukkha, and how can I let go of this, is already a clear recognition. It's just that the mind isn't ready to let go yet. So that using the qualities of patience, of loving kindness towards oneself, recognizing, man, this is suffering. That direction of loving kindness towards oneself, and those are helpful ways of priming the process for finally releasing or relinquishing, even on, you know, in little increments. It's something that we can do. That contemplation and that clear recognizing that this is dukkha is immediately putting in place the conditions that will start to move in the direction. Okay, a five khandhas question. How can consciousness, vijnana, be conscious of itself? I mean, if consciousness's nature is like a clear crystal that takes on the color of whatever passes through it, if its true nature is colorless, formless, how can it know itself? That's the problem with similes or images, because sometimes they don't quite match, so that we end up, you know, and sometimes they're really useful and good. Sometimes they're slightly flawed. So then, if we extrapolate from a flawed image, then we end up in a place of confusion or doubt. Then that's the function of consciousness. Through the Pali word itself, vijnana. Jnana is knowledge, and vin is to divide, so that it's already of a divided nature, of a certain diffuse nature, so that it's not some ultimate consciousness, as one would say, is sometimes used in spiritual circles. It's just the function of knowing, and that's what when the Buddha describes consciousness and its duty, the duty of consciousness of the eye, consciousness of the nose, consciousness of the tongue, consciousness, and through all the six senses, through consciousness of the mind itself. It's just a function of the quality of knowing within the mind. So the Buddha's approach to it is a bit more, it's a working definition, as opposed to a philosophical definition. We hear so much about being in Sangha and with good friends, such as we do on retreats, sitting together, and yet in the suttas, the Buddha often speaks of telling the bhikkhus to go sit in seclusion, under a tree, wherever. I know personally that I often prefer sitting alone than in a group. I hear very little of this talked about in a Dhamma talk or encouraged. Could you say more about this? Well, I mean, we get people to come together for 10 days and then I go and tell them to go away. It's not very useful. We're here together, so let's learn how to be together. But certainly that is a quality that is praised, and certainly at the monastery, then I mean, actually, our day-to-day life is structured in a way that we have time to be on our own. The monthly or say the way the monastery is structured so that different people will be able to have time in solitude at different times, and then we'll so that it's at the, in the monastery then we try to encourage that and instead when I was living in Thailand, then of course you got a lot of options for going off into seclusion, but here in America less so that we do use the monastery structure to encourage seclusion, but certainly the Buddha does encourage that. I mean, it's sort of they're side by side. As you say, you know, and we do speak about sangha and learning how to live in community because it's a skill that is helpful to cultivate, and then. Similarly, you would say we, you know, it's oftentimes it's not a quality that we talk about that much in to lay people or in a lay setting like this, just because the circumstances are such that trying to encourage a different tool to be used. I think that the Buddha I think I brought it came up a couple days ago, and I probably only just touched on it, but it was in the discourse that the Buddha, and it's actually a really good illustration of how the Buddha does it side by side. The discourse that the Buddha gave on half of the holy life, that where Ananda sort of said, "Oh, half the holy life is having good spiritual friends," and then the Buddha sort of said, "No, it's the whole of the holy life." But then he goes on to say, you know, how does one cultivate? How does one with good spiritual friends work or practice? And then the Buddha emphasizes the cultivation of each factor of the Eightfold Path, relying on seclusion, dispassion, cessation, relinquishment, so that from right view, right intention, right speech, through to right concentration, each of those factors is cultivated with this aspect. First one being seclusion, and then dispassion, cessation, relinquishment. So these are qualities to be bringing into the practice. Also, there's an emphasis both on physical seclusion, but then also the jitta viveka, the seclusion of the mind, which is the seclusion that is able to to not be drawn into the reactivity of the mind to its likes and dislikes and its sense impressions, so that and that's when we're cultivating seclusion, that's something that we need to be attentive to as well, because the you know, because sometimes we can be okay when there's no impingement, but as soon as there's contact in some way, then you know we either get swept up in it with excitement, or we just get irritated by it, or intimidated in some way, shaken by it. So that sense of the internal seclusion, the seclusion of the heart, is an important factor in when we're considering seclusion. I'm just trying to remember. I read it's not coming to mind. It was a very beautiful thought. I think it was from the Samyutta Nikaya, just the short verses in the Buddha speaking about seclusion. Okay, what do you think of using awareness itself as an object for meditation? Not open awareness, but the awareness of the body, where consciousness and the object meet. For example, that thin layer of awareness. Thank you. I think one of the things that is always important to come back to and emphasize is that whatever method or technique or object that we use, we have to be gauging and reflecting, is it for the increase of wholesome dhammas and the decrease of unwholesome dhammas? Is it for the increase of clarity or is it for the sort of increase in confusion? Any object is actually fair game. I mean, as you when the Buddha starts laying out all the different ways that we can be cultivating, there's a huge range of what is possible. The main thing is to say, does it work? So that if it works, if it's helpful for increasing clarity, stability, and wholesome and skillful states, then it's good. If it's sometimes a subtle object of attention is really helpful because it challenges one to really pay attention, be really clear, especially something like that where one's really trying to catch that how the mind establishes its awareness and consciousness. And sometimes it's a bit too obtuse and the mind just sort of starts to drift, so that one has to see for oneself what's working, what's beneficial. Okay, please describe any techniques or practices you can recommend for gladdening the mind. And that is a particular phrase that comes up in the discourse that the Buddha gives on mindfulness of breathing. Gladdening the mind, I breathe in. Gladdening the mind, I breathe out. And again, that's sort of leaning on what I just said, and sort of what you know, whatever works is important. But so then, a classic techniques for gladdening the mind are using the recollections of the Buddha. The actual recollection of the historical Buddha, recollection of stories of the Buddha, recollection of qualities of the Buddha. These are things that can gladden the mind. A recollection of a particular Dhamma teachings that have had an impact and have inspired the mind, and to go back and to review that, to bring those to mind, and often there'll be a gladdening result. Recollection of Sangha in the sense of the examples of other practitioners from the past or the present who have inspired or encouraged and bring a certain gladness to mind. So recollection, Buddha Dhamma Sangha, recollections of turning attention to the thoughts of loving kindness. That's a traditional way of bringing a certain quality of gladness to the mind. Recollections of generosity, recollections of virtue. These are all ways of gladdening the mind. When we direct attention to that which is wholesome and good, and in particular when we recognize that that's something that we have done, or in thinking particularly in terms of recollections of virtue, recollections of generosity, these are that brings a gladness to the mind when one recollects some of the associations that one has had. That brings a gladness to the mind, so one of the really beautiful customs that I heard of, that it's in Sri Lankan tradition, and when in a traditional sort of Buddhist Sri Lankan family, when a child is born, and I can't remember the name that they give it, but they're given a book, and as they grow up, they take this book, and once they learn to write, and they start to write in all of the skillful actions and wholesome things that they've done, and as they and they keep this book, and at times of illness or difficulty, and up to the time of death, then it will be read to them, so that it's very powerful. It's a little gladdening the mind of recollecting the goodness that one has done. So that's a really beautiful reflection, because oftentimes we it's just so easy to fixate on shortcomings and flaws and all sort of difficulties that one has had, and to actually have the evidence at hand that it's not as dire and disastrous as it feels sometimes. I'm struggling with aversion and doubt. When do I switch to metta? when they get sort of, when you drop the aversion to metta and the doubt that it won't work. uh, One of the things with I think it doesn't necessarily have to be metta, because that similar to with this the gladdening the mind. It's just, you know, the mind does. It gets hooked and caught by aversion. It gets caught by doubt, and finding different ways to gladden the mind, and metta is only one of them. Sometimes metta just sort of brings up more aversion. it's the classic story that Bhante Gunaratana tells of when he was going to Europe at one time to one of his first trips to Europe to teach meditation, and the person who was organizing the retreat asked him what he would be teaching, and he said, well, I'll be teaching this and teaching that, and then she said, will you be teaching metta? And he said, well, I'm not sure. There's lots of different things to teach. And, well, I hate metta. classic sort of conundrum. So that, yeah, that the different ways to gladden the mind. What are skillful ways to increase energy? Avirya. We're on a roll right now with this gladdening the mind. Because that does tend to lighten things. So when once there's that quality of lightness, then there's especially when it's wholesome and grounded in recollections of virtues and the teachings and examples of Buddha Dhamma Sangha, then. There's a natural inclination to want to put forth effort. When one does it out of, say, one tries to increase energy out of a feeling of kind of duty, or I should do it, then either, there's reluctance or resistance to actually putting forth effort or bringing up energy. But to be contemplating the benefits of an energetic mind, an energetic heart, and recognizing that we actually feel better when we put forth effort. It actually feels good, and sometimes that is a helpful way of getting over that initial inertia that tends to pull us down. So there's that contemplation of that every time that I do put forth an effort and put in good energy to the practice, and there's a tangible feeling of well-being. It just feels better. What is with the kasina? In many years of practice, this has never been taught by any of my teachers. How would it benefit one's practice compared to a life of contemplating the Four Noble Truths? How is the color chosen? Please explain how this practice fits in. Well, the casino is one of the reasons why it's generally not taught is because it's a very specific samatha practice or concentration practice, and you wouldn't have heard of it from me if somebody hadn't asked the questions about it. So I was just responding to a question. But the the ancient texts it's a part of the in the Visuddhimagga there's 40 meditation objects and 10 of them are casinas. They're different colors or sort of earth casino, water casino. And so that they're a visual object that one absorbs one's attention into. It's always helpful to have some guidance in doing that, because if there is strong concentration arise, then it's helpful to have some guidance. So oftentimes it's taught only in specific circumstances where a teacher thinks it might be beneficial to a practitioner. Usually one experiments with different colors or one is drawn to a particular color, but it's something that one experiments with. But it's not a common practice these days. There's a lot more emphasis in all of the traditions that I know. Certainly, the forest tradition of either short mantra, mindfulness of breathing, and then contemplation of Four Noble Truths, keeping it straight and straightforward. And uncomplicated. I found the story of Ajahn Tate both instructive and inspiring. I've searched on the web and found a brief autobiography and just a few teachings. Do you know of any other resources to learn from and about this wise Tara? There isn't much there. There wasn't that many Westerners who stayed with him, so that not much of his teachings got translated. But the story that I related came from, and I don't, can't remember the. The actual name of it, I'm sure it would. You'd be able to find it online. Everything's online. Something about moss. Something about moss. Moss is in the title, and the person who wrote it is I think Norwegian. Do you remember? Issues through the moss. Anybody remember her name? Okay. Yeah, she's from I think Norway, something like that. But she had studied with Ajahn Tate, and then she wrote her experiences. Ajahn Tate praised her practice real highly. Would you please repeat the phrasing of the Four Noble Truths and the mind that you spoke of this morning? Thank you. In brackets, I am grasping and suffering. Just knowing that much is good. Having a clear equation. You know, grasping equals suffering. So that the way that it was laid out was the Four Noble Truths, but turned so that rather than sort of suffering cause, cessation path, they're turned around. The first is the mind going out, or the mind going outside of itself, the mind directed outward is the cause of suffering, and samudaya, it's the cause of suffering, and the result of the mind going out or being directed outward is suffering. The mind seeing the mind knowing the mind is the path, and the result of the mind seeing the mind, mind knowing the mind is cessation of suffering. What role is there for Buddhist nuns in North America? Are there any plans for a monastery for Buddhist nuns? I mean, there's a couple here one in Sonoma and one in the Bay Area for Theravada, and I think there's a huge role for ordained nuns, Buddhist nuns, to set an example, to practice, and to be able to teach. So that there's one in Sonoma County out on the coast, and then there's one in San Francisco that is there in a small vihara, and looking to find a place in the countryside where there can be a more conducive environment for training others. So there's definitely a role. What does the Vinaya set as the standard for personal hygiene? Bathing, cleaning, clothes, shaving, and in monastic life. Specifically, how often should one bathe, shave? Is the use of deodorant within the purview of the Vinaya? The Buddha dealt with everything. right down to sort of nose hairs and ear hairs. What was that? What are these? What did you say it looked like? Was some sort of yucca or something? A goblin. Or was it? Huh?
Goblin.
Because covers the nose hairs sort of growing out. So if you say, trim those nose hairs, you're looking like a goblin. The Buddha was, besides these incredible teachings on liberation and sort of ultimate emptiness, blah, 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 the standard for personal hygiene, eating, walking, sitting, moving, interacting, keeping things patched. I mean, like our robes. If I get a If I get a hole in my robe, because we have to determine them for use, so that if I get a hole in my robe, then that robe is no longer considered a robe. It's just a piece of cloth that doesn't have a clear determination as my robe. So then I need to patch that and then redetermine it for its proper function, so that before the next dawn, I need to patch. If I get a hole, I need to patch. The ways of eating and not making noise, not slurping, the Buddha just sort of covered everything. And a part of it was his own. I remember one time when I did a tudong in India, and which is just walking as an alms mendicant by myself, or I was by myself at the time. Ajahn Jayasaro and I went together, and then we walked for a while, and then he went off in another direction, and then this was at Bodh Gaya, and this Kshatriya, who's from the warrior caste, which is what the same caste that the Buddha was born in, and he'd been watching me for days, and finally came up and started talking to me, and was saying, you do things just like I've been trained to do. So it was really interesting because, in the noble warrior caste, they receive a training, and so that the Buddha used much of his own, say, standard of etiquette and good conduct to set as a standard for the monastics, how we lived and how we look after ourselves and how our deportment and areas, and certainly around just the areas of even of cleanliness and whatnot, because it was to a certain degree, it was a radical thing to have all these different castes living together, and so there needed to be a standard that was not, did give a sense of confidence and inspiration to the other members of the culture and society, particularly the ruling noble classes, as well as the sort of the Brahmins, who were the kind of the religious kind of holders of the religious stakes, so that there is a fairly comprehensive standards and training in all the areas of our life. Only half in jest. How are we to reflect on the use of food? Not for fun, not for pleasure, only for the maintenance and nourishment of the body, when offered Paul's spectacular cooking. It's a lot easier, in that sense. But it's important to keeping things to mind, and that's what the use of reflection is. It isn't necessarily that you're going to mandate what you're feeling or thinking, but you're keeping a perspective on it, so that it's one of maybe reining in a certain exuberance or tendency to proliferation or excitement about something, so that one, through the reflection, it doesn't mean that one doesn't enjoy it, but it's sort of, okay, I can, I don't need to get excited about it. And one can still feel gratitude and appreciation. That's you know, the Buddha. I mean, this is a good example of the training in the Vinaya again, of the discipline where you know, the Buddha does give these reflections. Okay, you know, it's sort of sobering and be restrained. But then in the rules of discipline, one of the things that the Buddha prescribes is toothwoods for cleaning the teeth and the mouth. And when he speaks of using the toothwoods, and he also said the different benefits that comes from using the toothwoods. And one of the benefits, I think there's five different benefits of using toothwoods, and then one of the benefits is that food tastes better. So that it's just is a practical aside. Okay. I sometimes chant the refuges to my dog. She doesn't seem to mind. Can't tell if she's listening. Is it possible to help our beloved canine companions on the path? I thought I heard that of all the animals, dogs have most chance of a human birth. Well, I think one of the, say, the ways, main ways of say, animals being able to take human birth is that association and that kind of connection that's made. Yeah, as long as she doesn't mind, I just keep doing it. and even if she isn't listening, at least you are, which is you know, that's a benefit already. But I think in America, I mean, dogs are—it's a real heavenly realm for dogs. They're so well treated. After the talk this morning, during the short meditation, I was overcome with a sense of joy that was maintained during the walking meditation that followed. As I slowly walked, reflecting on this joy, I also heard the rumble of the freeway traffic. My reflections then went to how I might maintain this focus and joy when I move back into the rumble and chaos of my workaday world. Any suggestions? Well, I think one of it is the just that sense of memory of the joy that one experiences when hearing Dhamma, reflecting on Dhamma. And that's one of the functions of, say, Dhamma no Sati, the recollection of Dhamma, is also to reconnect with a sense of well-being and happiness that comes from that perception of truth. It's also helpful to be recollecting on impermanence. And one of the truths of the Dhamma is also that even joy and insights will tend to be impermanent. So, not to be shocked or dismayed when it does slip or when it isn't there. or think that somehow one has to that you know, so one sets that sort of intention. Oh, this is how I'm going to feel now. And then of course it isn't that way. It isn't a permanent state. So that too, bringing to mind the truth of the Dhamma, but that those memories of an insight, those memories of joy at the Dhamma, those are really beneficial to be able to bring into being. Not so much that one's just trying to replicate it and cling to it, but in and of itself, it's a wholesome mental state that one wants to support and to be able to recollect. And that's this. When I was saying that in the Visuddhimagga, there's 40 different meditation techniques, and 10 of them are kasinas. Well, 10 of them are also recollections, the anusati. So those are bringing to mind, recalling certain positive and wholesome and skillful states, memories, and that seeds the practice in a wholesome way, because we do need to nourish the practice in different ways, and that nourishing through positive associations, joyous memories. Those are very useful. And please explain what condition gave rise to the 28 Buddha's protection discourse. Is this a sutta? It didn't start with "thus have I heard." Did Buddha ever mention or acknowledge the existence of other Buddhas? In the suttas and the Vinaya scriptures, the ancient scriptures, then the Buddha only mentions other Buddhas, previous Buddhas. He mentions a coming Buddha. But when he mentions previous Buddhas, I think it's only two or three. Am I correct? Like Vipassi and Kassapa. And then like sort of the whole 28 Buddhas is like a much later text. And I don't even know where it comes from.
The verses at the end of the Digha Nikaya relate to that.
There's kind of relates to it. There's the Atthanatiya Sutta in the Digha Nikaya, which sort of relates to a little bit of it. And I think what's happened is later writers or commentators have then written these verses, so it's a much, much later text,
like what you have in the Nidana Sanyuta, like the first 10 of mm-hmm. the talk about dependent origination,
uh-huh.
all the different previous Buddhas who. Like 10 different Buddhas.
Oh, really?
Okay.
So, yeah. So that in the Ajahn Yatiko was just saying that in the Sanyutta Nikaya, the Nidana Sanyutta, then the first discourses are in reference to about 10 other Buddhas who had the same insight that the Buddha did. But so that there's mention in that. I know in Thailand when the recitation of the 28 Buddhas is considered to be a powerful protection and blessing, particularly protection against ghosts and spirits.
I know you said that it's from the Buddha Wangsa.
It's from the Buddha Wangsa.
The 28 Buddhas.
28 Buddhas, oh, okay. So Buddha Wangsa is a Sri Lankan text. Easily, would that be close to 1,000 years after the 500 to 1,000 years after the Buddha passed away? So it's an ancient Sri Lankan text. For the Thais that's the only time I've heard it chanted is usually as a protection against ghosts and spirits, and so there's a whole kind of fantastic realms and worlds of all the different spirits and ghosts in Thailand, and kids grow up. They grow up when their kids scared of ghosts, and they keep that all the way through their whole life usually. It's a different perception. They also usually sort of in Thai culture you don't use corporal punishment so much, with children. You don't really hit them or spank them too much. And you scare the crap out of them with ghost stories. these ghosts are going to eat your liver, you little brat. Okay, that's all the questions today, so we can have a short break and come back for chanting.